my main response to the world is not one of anger. As I get older, I find it's one of disappointment. One of disappointment.
I was so disappointed by the events of the day.
Everybody will be so disappointed.
Let me take you through the story of the most disappointing film I have ever seen. And I think the most disappointing film ever made, and I think the most culturally disappointing thing that has ever happened.
So how are you then, you big bloody man?
I'm good. I've had a few things to work through, you know.
With Sarah?
No, with George Lucas.
Hi, I'm Wendy. And you're listening to So Disappointed, the podcast that asks you about some of the things that have really let you down. Disappointment comes in so many forms. Maybe you've been disappointed by a film or television franchise, or an artist you admire, a political figure, an ideology, or just the human race in general. The permutations are endless. We'll be looking at why we get so invested in people and things to such an extent that we get angry when they let us down. Why do we care? What's wrong with us and what's wrong with them? In this, the final episode of our current series, we'll be looking at a film that almost instantly became shorthand for a kind of cataclysmic pop culture disappointment against which all others are measured. And that's quite an achievement, you have to admit.
You refer to the prophecy of the one who will bring balance to the Force. You believe it's this boy?
He can see things before they happen.
He can help you.
The Force is unusually strong with him.
He was meant to help you.
Anakin! Tell him to take off!
Will I ever see you again?
What does your heart tell you?
Are you sure about this? Trusting our fate to a boy we hardly know?
Anakin Skywalker, meet Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I sense much fear in you.
The boy is dangerous. They all sense it. Why can't you?
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
Written and directed by franchise creator George Lucas, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, was undoubtedly the most eagerly awaited film event of 1999. The first installment of a prequel trilogy set before the events of the blockbuster Star Wars films released between 1977 and 1983. It traced the origin story of young Anakin Skywalker, an innocent child who, following a series of unfortunate events, would later go on to become the mercilessly evil galactic tyrant, Darth Vader. Even though Lucas hadn't actually written or directed a film since Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, in 1977, and had spent the previous few years annoying fans by pedantically tinkering with the original trilogy, expectations were stratospheric. Three brand new Star Wars films were on their way. And the trailers for the first one looked incredible. There was just no way this wasn't going to be one of the greatest things ever. Well, you know what happened next. The film was an enormous box office hit. That was always a foregone conclusion. But the critical response was mixed, to say the least. The general consensus was that while Some of the action scenes were quite well handled. The actual story was dull, nonsensical, and convoluted. The dialogue was dreadful. The acting was wooden. There was a terrible overabundance of unconvincing CGI. And if all that wasn't bad enough, it even featured a couple of jaw-droppingly offensive racial stereotypes. Frankly speaking, it was a mess. Worse, it was a boring mess. Fans weren't just disappointed. They were stunned by just how much the film fell short of their expectations. As daft as this may sound to some, we're talking the five stages of grief here. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and finally, a kind of acceptance.
That's impossible!
Set your feelings, you know it to be true.
No! No!
And kids, I was there. 1999, the Odeon in Renfrew Street in Glasgow. Managed to get tickets for the midnight showing. Some of the last tickets left, we were pretty close to the front and far over to the side. I was with my boyfriend at the time, who was an enormous Star Wars fan. I wasn't so much, but I was excited. I thought I was about to have my life changed by this film. But all I remember was stumbling out into the darkness, 3 a.m. in the morning, and my boyfriend being quiet. Now, this is a man who is Star Wars obsessed, still Star Wars obsessed, to the extent that he has a Jedi symbol tattooed on his leg. And he had nothing to say. And he stayed quiet for a few days until he bought tickets to sit right in the middle of the cinema, directly in front of the screen, a few days later. And we came out and he said, "Well, that didn't help. That didn't help at all. That film is still terrible." We had gone back to watch the film from a different angle, just in case watching it face on would have helped. Talk about denial. While preparing for this episode, we asked the good people of Blue Sky to share their memories of seeing The Phantom Menace for the first time. And we received loads of fantastic responses, including this one from Christopher James.
"The only film I've ever walked out of. My abiding memory after years of buying Star Wars magazine and following the production with excitement was crushing disappointment at it being so dull. I was embarrassed that I took people to it and could feel their boredom like a heavy fog in the cinema."
Carrie Bookish.
"I was firmly seated in the cinema, ready to have a good time. Instead, trade talks droned on. A bizarre and offensive character dominated the screen. I had to find my joy in fan fiction. The Fix-It Fic writers had never had better material to work on."
Fix-It Fic writers?
"Fan fiction writers deciding to fix what's wrong with their source material by rewriting the core story so it makes more sense."
Alex Wormel.
"I remember the huge excitement and buzz as we went into the cinema at Leicester Square on opening night, and the enormous sense of deflation as we piled out at the end."
And Mark Maynard.
"Taught me to keep my expectation levels in check. Resentment leads to pain. Pain leads to the dark side."
Let's check in with our resident psychologist, the always enlightening David Myers. We spoke to some of our listeners, some of our followers on Blue Sky. And I tell you what, people really want to talk about this. It's like...
It's like a JFK moment, you know, where were you when? Everybody mm-hmm. seemed to have a story about going to see The Phantom Menace. So we got an avalanche of responses from people talking about their experience of it. And I would say a heavy handful were talking about the fact that they'd come out of the cinema and were trying really hard to talk themselves into believing it had been a good film. And they were sitting with their mates trying to figure out why they had experienced it as a bad film. And I was thinking, ooh, this is cognitive dissonance, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. We spoke about in the previous episode about dismissing something that threatens what you know about the world
yeah.
as a way of resolving the dissonance. For something like this, if what you've just seen is supposed to be a missing piece of a puzzle and it really, really doesn't fit, particularly if you're a massive fan of this huge series of films, it's much more slow process. It's almost a bit like, kind of, what just happened to me there? And so you go through a much, I think, slower process in terms of resolving the dissonance in some way.
I think a lot of people went back and watched it again. And that, mm-hmm. and certainly that was my experience. Go back, watch it again, come out and go, no, actually, that was really bad. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. there's this sense of betrayal.
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be explained by the kind of parasocial relationship people will have with the franchise or a particular character or an aspect of the story. Obviously, in those kind of situations, people are really deeply invested in Star Wars as an entity almost in its own right, but they can't possibly influence that. So it's a one-way, unreal relationship. But like any relationship that disappoints you, and, you know, we'll all think of examples of this from real life that's disappointed us in a similar way, you kind of give the other party a second chance, maybe X number of chances until yeah. you get to the point where you become really quite ambivalent or hateful or angry. So you probably tolerate it enough until you can't tolerate it at all.
Yeah. Wow. So we're in a relationship with Star Wars. So what else do you think is going on here?
The first three films were iconic. They took science fiction in a different direction from anything that had come before. They also became a massive cultural phenomenon out with being a film. Everybody had Star Wars toys. There were spin-off comics and books. They formed a huge part of the childhoods of millions of people, and also the lives of people who were older than the kids who grew up with it. People obviously look back on those aspects of their lives with a great deal of fondness, and that's what's known as nostalgia. Nostalgia is grounded in our positive past experiences. It also helps to strengthen shared social bonds. It's important in all of our social groups, including fandoms. Fandoms operate as any other kind of social group does, even though the people are perhaps involved in them are perhaps quite disparate in terms of their physical location from each other. One thing about nostalgia, though, is it's important to note that we attach more significance to those events that we remember fondly than are probably really due to them. The reason for that is because those feelings make us feel good. So there's an inherent positivity bias at play when we're feeling nostalgic. So when Lucas announced the production of the three prequel films, that evoked everybody's feelings of nostalgia for the original films, also the toys, the comics, their childhoods, their friendships, and everything else that was associated with Star Wars at that earlier point in their life. So for me at this point, something known as the Rosie effect comes into play. And that comes from Mitchell and Thompson's 1994 rather long-named theory of temporal adjustments of the evaluation of events. Mm-hmm. That theory has three components. The first is called rosy prospection, which is when people anticipate future events more positively or favourably than they actually experience them when they happen. Mm-hmm. The opposite of that is rosy retrospection, and that's when people recall past events as having been more positive or favourable than they actually were. The third factor is called dampening, and that's when people minimise the positivity of an experience that they're currently going through. So what I think might have been going on was that the opposing phenomena, if you like, of rosy prospection and rosy retrospection could well have been at play in fans' negative reactions to The Phantom Menace. Rosy retrospection means that fans could well have overestimated the degree of favourability of their memory for the original films. Coupled with that, the hype surrounding the film and the tendency towards rosy prospection sets up an unrealistically positive expectation in the minds of fans.
You are so blind. You so do not understand. You weren't there at the beginning. You don't know how good it was, how important. This is it for you. This jumped up firework display of a toy advert. People like you make me sick. What's wrong with you?
And this then is where negativity bias or negativity dominance enter the picture. As a species, we're still very much alive to threats. Negative entities have more significance for us than their positive equivalents, and that's known as negative potency. Mm-hmm. And we treat negative entities with more seriousness than their positive equivalents, and that's known as negative dominance. This has an evolutionary origin. It's all about survival. You want to know what the negative things are, so you stay away from them and people stay alive. As I mentioned earlier, fandoms are like social groups like any other, and they operate with similar dynamics. Fans and fandoms are highly motivated by the object that they're fans of. Remember, of course, fan is short for fanatic, and that comes from the Latin word fanaticus, which means inspired by a deity or frenzied. And I think that's probably quite an important thing to remember. Their being fans is an intrinsic aspect of their identity. So for some fans, they feel that it's almost as much as an aspect of them as their DNA in some ways.
Yeah.
Since The Phantom Menace did not live up to the hype, this was seen by fans as a threat to the group. And by extension, the problems they perceived with the film became a threat to them. These perceived threats triggered a negative emotional reaction, and there was a new way by which fans could very quickly warn other members of the group about the threat that didn't exist before, and that's the internet.
Yes.
Ah, yes, the internet. We discussed the growing significance of that newfangled phenomenon in the very first episode of So Disappointed, an episode devoted to the other major film event of 1999, The Blair Witch Project. And if you're impressed by the way Paul and I have cleverly structured this first series with a complementary set of bookends, then we're not about to disabuse you of that notion. I mean, okay, it was a happy accident, all right? But still, here's our very special guest, the writer Alex Mel Taylor, to tell us all about the role the internet played in the Phantom Menace backlash saga.
My name is Alex, they, her pronouns. I run a blog on Medium called Alex Has Opinions, and I'm also part of a writer's cooperative called After the Storm magazine, which focuses on speculative fiction.
Alex, you have opinions about episode one, The Phantom Menace.
I really do. It's such an interesting movie because it came at the intersection of so many things. It's of course, it came at the intersection of George Lucas's career, and he had a lot of pressure there. And I don't think he collaborated with as many people as he did the first set of movies. And so the product was not as good, in my opinion, as the original trilogy. But it also, the internet became a major factor. You had this brand, Star Wars, that people sort of had built up in their heads for years, right? From the 70s to 1999, became this sort of like cultural moment, sort of similar to Star Trek. And so the expectations were really high. And then when those expectations were not met, it sort of became this thing you dumped on online. Like a lot of YouTubers in particular made their career like dunking on this movie. It's interesting because it's like, it's not a movie I particularly think is amazing, but I think that there was sort of this hyped up negativity around it because of everything around it.
Why do you think that the reaction to the prequels was just so intense?
I think that part of the reaction was, I think we were at the beginning of this sort of culture where people were learning to make their careers by saying thing bad. But like, that's like a common thing that you see on YouTube and TikTok. Like, why is this media the worst thing that has ever existed? Someone will go into it and they'll have a take. And that's fine, but it's to get you sort of like angry and to click. And we weren't as inoculated against that. I think now when someone releases a take that's like, this is the worst thing that has ever existed, we're like, okay, come on, man. We know this isn't true. But back then, I think that people were new to these sort of YouTubers, and they were sort of like, especially if you were growing up at that time and you were building your media literacy, and your primary media critics weren't like a newspaper, but they were like a YouTuber telling you that this was the worst thing ever, and the mechanisms weren't in place. Like, they still sort of suck today, but they weren't in place to sort of like regulate like harassment. It led to this intense situation. The actor that played Anakin, like the young Anakin, he was harassed. He quit acting. Like, it wasn't just like people were like, oh, this is bad. People had intense opinions on that. And those sort of movements became part of like larger movements. Like, now that's like the norm. The norm is that if you disagree with someone, a political movement will try to dox and harass them. But it was sort of newish using those technologies.
Jake Lloyd was 10 years old when the film came out.
Yes.
Which means he must have been 8 years old when he was auditioning, 9 years old when he was making it. This is a tiny child being catapulted into this role, Darth Vader, Anakin Skywalker. Yes. And he's a kid. Watching the trailer and watching the film again, he's pretty good.
Yes.
But I think the expectation was that he was going to deliver some kind of Dustin Hoffman level Oscar winning performance at 8 years old. But the response to him was brutal, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I think that people are just sort of mean to kids sort of in general. Like, there's people that will, like, they'll see a child actor and the actor will have sort of a nasally voice and they'll be like, I hate this. And you're like, well, that's sort of how kids sound like. Like, the modern day example I think of is Bluey, the television show, where those kids, their identity is locked down.
Yeah.
No one knows who they are, because if people did, they would receive a lot of harassment. And we've sort of learned the lessons that, like, we're increasingly learning that, like, you can't expose children to the direct public on the internet like that. Otherwise, it will be sort of terrible. I didn't enjoy The Phantom Menace as much. And I think that The Phantom Menace is actually one of the tighter of the trilogy. Like, The Clone Wars, I'm not a fan of. Revenge of the Sith, the last one, I think is okay. And it has that really great line, which is like, this is how democracy dies, with thunderous applause, where Natalie Portman is saying it. And it's fantastic. I wish I could see the movie that line was about. And it's called Andor.
Andor, in case you didn't know, is a critically acclaimed and decidedly adult-themed Star Wars TV spin-off, examining the horrors of fascist imperialism. The wacky antics of comedy black hole Jar Jar Binks are conspicuous by their absence. We recommend it. Now, back to Alex. Just to sort of come back to what you were saying, that this was one of the first films that was picked apart online. And because, I guess, the nature of it, you know, Star Wars is, I don't want to say Star Wars is for geeks. I am a geek. I'm a Star Trek geek. But, you know, we found the people who were into science fiction found a home online very, very early. And so it makes sense that we would be there. What do you think that the internet or the scope of the internet did to the way that people responded to the film? Do you think it sort of increased the hysteria?
Yes, I think it absolutely did. It's funny because in retrospect, people's perspective on the Clone Wars era has very softened. And thanks to the cartoons, pretty much, the Clone Wars cartoons, people like that era now. Or not everyone, but it's not that period in the Star Wars canon is not treated as hostily or as aggressively as it was back then. It did seem to be sort of a hysteria. And I don't know about you, but I just remember that sort of being my entire adulthood and young adulthood and childhood would be these sort of micro scandals that had to do with like media. Like this was sort of the beginning of the quote unquote culture war where people would just sort of blow up on things. It was the genesis is sort of there. I don't think people think of it, but it's just because people probably would trace it to like Gamergate. But I think the culture of us just sort of having like moral panic culture war moments over a piece of media that almost began right out of the gate in Star Wars.
We began this episode with a quote from our resident film critic, Eddie Harrison, in which he summed up his profound disappointment with The Phantom Menace. As we've heard, he wasn't alone. So let's finish up now with more of Eddie's thoughts. And as always, he does not disappoint.
I was a huge fan of the original Star Wars, and I feel privileged to be of the generation that saw it at exactly the right age, at exactly the right point in your life. Nobody in Britain saw Star Wars in 1977 because it only came out in America. It was delayed, and it came out in 1978, and I was 10 years old when I rocked up to see Star Wars. In fact, I'd been 9 years old, I think. When I rocked up to see Star Wars, I was taken by my family, and it was just the most mind-blowing experience. You know, I'd watched films as a kid, and it was just like two men talking to each other. And then you saw this incredible, loud, multicolored universe, you know, mind-blowing kind of movie that was just rammed with like robots and giant monkeys and all this kind of stuff. I remember seeing a clip of Star Wars the year before on Clapboard, long forgotten ITV kind of film program. And I remember afterwards kind of drawing on a bit of my dad's office paper a kind of image of this golden C-3PO robot and this kind of tin R2-D2 like giant bin that he was, and kind of, you know, it was almost like the kind of vision of Close Encounters, like what did I just see, and trying to note it down. And then we got taken to see this movie, and the feeling of watching it and leaving the cinema like weak at the knees that you had seen this extraordinary, like revolutionary, groundbreaking movie. You'd had that kind of childhood with Star Wars. So we fast forward to 1999 and we're going to party like it's 1999. This is not just the end of the decade, but the end of the century and the end of the millennium. And we're all alive. And this is going to be the visionary, life-changing work. It's going to be Star Wars. They're going to bring back Star Wars. And in fact, I also remember being in Grauman's Chinese Theater watching The Matrix. And the trailer came on for Star Wars and it got a standing ovation. The entire cinema got to its feet and applauded all the way through the trailer. That is how excited people were about Star Wars. We just knew for sure that this was going to be great. Steven Spielberg had said, I've already seen this film and it is going to blow your minds. And there was no way whatsoever that this was going to be a bad movie.
But then, like all of us, you actually saw the movie. So what was that experience like?
I saw it in the ABC in Sucky Hall Street. And the first thing was the opening crawl of credits. And it's all about tax and about blockades and your first kind of thought is like, is this the wrong film? Is this, you know, Star Wars is like presumably meant to be for kids, or maybe it could be for adults, or maybe it could be for both. But something about tax is not for anyone. Like, nobody wants to see a movie about tax. Nobody wants to see a movie about accountancy and whatever. And it was almost like a kind of bait and switch that you'd been promised one movie. Again, there's a great poster, which I know you used for your preparation for this, of the little Anakin Skywalker is at 6 years old and the shadow of Darth Vader behind him. And again, it kind of promised this kind of almost kind of Godfather level that we're going to see a trilogy of films about Darth Vader and we're going to look at the dark side of Star Wars. So we're going to see something that's kind of grown up and kind of more thoughtful than what we've seen. And then the film started and it is just absolutely dreadful. This O-faced diplomacy, there's people wittering on about planets that you've never heard of and you don't really understand what's going on. And the first thing that hits you is this has no continuity with Star Wars. This doesn't actually fit with the rest of it. You know, in The Phantom Menace, we have a six-year-old boy who is a fighter pilot, you know, who takes part and actually wins for the Rebels. So there are no children fighter pilots in Star Wars. That's not part of any of the previous films. So you're already having this kind of disconnect, like, wait a minute, do you remember what Star Wars is like? We remember what it's like, but the people that made this film don't seem to kind of know anything about it. And things that you were kind of looking forward to, it's like, okay, the Jedi Knights, let's see what they're like. When you see the Jedi Council in this film, I've never seen such a bunch of losers. They've all got these funny shaped heads and these ridiculous costumes, and they just look absolutely pitiful. And you're kind of like, you're taking the things that I love and you're making something kind of completely rotten out of it. So then you start getting into this real kind of continuity issues. Like in Star Wars, the Empire have stormtroopers, which are like men in white suits, and they've got terrible aim. Okay, so we go backwards, like, what, 100 years to The Phantom Menace, and somehow the Empire have got these incredible robots with force fields that can fly, and in fact, all the characters can fly, and it's like, what is this? This doesn't match with anything that we like about Star Wars. So the lack of continuity starts to get really grating. These awful performances, you know, you could cast all these actors that we love, like Natalie Portman, Liam Neeson, Ewan McGregor. Can't wait to see these people. We've seen them great in other movies. And then you're watching them and they're clearly standing in front of green screens. The technology wasn't ready to do what George Lucas wanted to do with it. They're standing in front of green screens and they're talking to like ping pong balls and they're just giving these flat performances where all they talk about is diplomacy and blockades, and it's just so completely and utterly boring. And then you're kind of getting to, okay, so let's bring on the characters that we kind of do like. One of the things that I never understood about The Phantom Menace is that we see that Darth Vader, when he was a little boy, when he was 6 years old, and this makes no sense at all, built C-3PO. It's like, you see him literally, you know, with a screwdriver putting C-3PO together. Now, if that is the case, and I don't want to get too nerdy about it, but if that is the case, why does Darth Vader never recognise C-3PO when he sees him in Star Wars? You know, when in The Empire Strikes Back, they get to Cloud City and they walk in with C-3PO, Darth Vader should go, oh, I built that when I was 6 years old. I remember that. That's something, that's my work. I created that. He doesn't say anything about it. And the problem is that George Lucas cannot remember from one film to another what kind of world he had created. And then there's another thing that really, really gets to me, which is that they go into, where did Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader, where did he come from? And there's a line in the film where they say, it was a virgin birth. And that notion that, listen, we argue about anything about Star Wars. We argue about the color of the lightsabers. We argue about every single aspect of it, how the Death Star crash compactor worked. But nobody took the bait from George Lucas. Nobody is interested in this quasi-religious idea of kind of Star Wars having something to do with religion. Nobody is interested in that aspect. And George Lucas's ability to pick aspects of this world to develop that are not the ones, a bit like the Matrix films, that we kind of immediately found out that what the audience liked about it was not the same as the people who created the film. So all of these things are kind of working against, and the deadening experience of sitting watching this, that after about 20 minutes of the new film, you're just like, no, wait, can we just stop and start this again? Because this is giving me absolutely nothing of what I want about Star Wars. And in fact, you're taking all the things I love about it and you're ruining them one by one.
This is very, very bad.
And that feeling of just leaving the cinema after The Phantom Menace and feeling that your dreams had been absolutely trampled on, it had been absolutely ruined. And also, like, The Phantom Menace is like, you've got like something like 12 good guys and one bad guy, the Darth Maul, Peter Serafinovich character. And it's like the odds are completely the opposite. Like, Star Wars is all about rebellion and it's all about hope. And somehow you turned it into something that was completely the opposite. So you've got 12 good guys looking for a bad guy. And this, again, Darth Maul, you'd seen him in the pictures. He looked so ferocious. And then you see him and he rides around in a little tiny tricycle kind of bike in the sandy planet. And when you fight him at the end, he lasts for about 5 minutes and then he dies. It's like that he's such a complete and utter pushover. You've also got, just, you know, beginning to really pick up steam now, wildly racist, anti-Semitic characterization. Yeah. You know, just absolutely horrific decision. Jar Jar Binks is bad enough. There's another one, I think, called Watto. And they're horrible, kind of like negative, like something out of a kind of flipping Nazi thing from the 1930s. How they could possibly have thought that this was going to help them sell pajama cases, I do not know.
Just one more round, friend, then homeward bound, friend. Don't forget me in your dreams.
Just one more. As Master Yoda did not say in The Phantom Menace, disappointment is a path to the dark side. Disappointment leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. And hate leads to suffering. Thanks for listening.
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama, papa coming for you. I'm the space invader. I'll be a rock and rolling bitch for you. Keep your mouth shut. You're smoking like a big monkey.
Thank you so much for listening to So Disappointed. You can find us on Blue Sky and Instagram. We would love to hear from you. We're interested in hearing your ideas for episodes for Series 2 of So Disappointed, which is coming in late spring 2026. We'd like to thank the contributors for this episode. Eddie Harrison, film critic. Alex Mel Taylor, blogger and writer. Sprite Kirkwood, actor, and David Myers, psychologist. We'd also like to thank everybody who engaged with us on social media as we were researching this episode. If you enjoy So Disappointed, please like it, rate it, review it wherever you get your podcasts, and tell a friend. Word of mouth is the most powerful way of growing our little project. And finally, thanks to Dan Jackson, who makes the music for So Disappointed. You can find links and information on our contributors in the show notes or at sodisappointedpod.com.
This is going to be one of these, it's like the roller coaster that starts very, very kind of slow as it goes up to the hill. But once we start talking about The Phantom Menace, I fear all hell is going to break loose. So let's just enjoy this moment of calm before the storm.